I live in a really fun neighborhood, but it's weird. So there's like only one-way streets around it, so it's really difficult to get in and out. You have to know what you're doing, is my point. And I tell you that because I often find myself have a large car that doesn't make good U-turns. And I find myself often, for years now, doing a lot of three-point turns on my streets, turning around to go the other way. And so what I found, like if you live in our neighborhood, my van is quite recognizable. If you see me doing that, it's because I went the wrong way in the neighborhood to where I was trying to go. And I tell you that because sometimes it's like a genuine oops, like there's a one-way street, but a lot of times it isn't quite like that. There's a lot of times that I'm like hustling to get out the door, I'm going somewhere, and I have certain routes that I run every day to my office, to, you know, here, to there, to the kids' school and sports drop-offs and pickups. And I'm in such a routine with those things that if I'm in a hurry and I'm going somewhere else, if I'm not paying attention, I'll find myself like halfway down the road in the wrong direction because I'm just on like an autopilot mode trying to get myself to where I want to go, which is the opposite direction. And I've sort of like run a route so many times that if I'm not careful, if I'm not thinking, if I'm not paying attention, I'll find myself going the wrong way. And sometimes, you know, I'll use an example that our neighborhood is complex. Sometimes Jen will tease me and say I just have a terrible sense of direction. Not so. Not so, baby. It's because sometimes I run on autopilot. And sometimes it's because I'm just really busy and I got a lot of things in my mind, and I'm just not thinking. But other times it's habits that have been formed again and again and again. Have you ever been driving in your car and you accidentally like blow by your like freeway exit because you're sort of distracted, or you'll find yourself at some other place than you intended to be? That kind of stuff happens. Like I'll kind of push into the kitchen, and I meant to grab something, but like there's so much on my mind, or I'm kind of distracted that I'll get back to my office in my house, and I don't have the thing that I went to get, but I have something else, and I don't really know what happened. I kind of blacked out in the last 45 seconds or so, and I'm like, dang it, I gotta go get the other thing, and why am I holding this piece of food that I didn't intend to grab? Like that kind of stuff happens, but there's also like deeply ingrained patterns that just exist. Like if you go to bed and wake up at the same time every day, you've trained your body and you don't even need to set an alarm. You're just gonna wake up at that time. You get exhausted at that time. It's also true of like our emotions or our relationships, or like habits, like even ways of thinking and ways of acting and ways of operating in the world. We can train ourselves into habits where you're running on autopilot, and oftentimes it can come from busyness, but other times you've just like routed your mind that way. In fact, I've read that that's how the mind works. It's a complex sort of neural system that you can map like routes of thought and processes through. And I've heard it described in analogy like as if it's like a grass field. And if you think a certain way, or you run a certain action, or you do a certain thing, like it's like you build like a grass sort of path through the field, and you keep running that path over and over, and it's eventually going to turn into a dirt path, and eventually to a dirt road, and eventually you're going to like put some concrete on that thing, and before long it's like a superhighway where you just find yourself on the entrance ramp and you're going to shoot out the exit where it is, and it's like you automatically get sucked down the path because you've created this sort of map in your head and your brain and the way that you think and the way that you operate. Or maybe like certain development has taken place in your life, whether that's intentionally, which can happen through childhood or through intentional actions, or even unintentionally, things that have happened to you that shape your experience and your formation just as like a human being, and you end up in this kind of pattern and this habit and this way of being in the world that very much runs subconsciously that you aren't even aware of often, and then just kind of operates in its own system, and you find yourself being like sucked along with it as a human being, right? Now, we're talking about transformation as a church. We're actually doing a big series called The Kingdom Society, where we're taking a whole year from January all the way through to the new year in one big 52-week series on what is it to become a people of Jesus? What is it to actually intentionally give ourselves over to becoming a people of God's kingdom? How do we live into it and embody it and own it and be these people? Not just talk about it, but actually become it. And we're spending some time talking about discipleship, and specifically as we're breaking it up, we're talking about transformation right now. We're actually at the end of a four-week series on transformation. From here, we're going to go into a lot of really fun stuff through the rest of the year. We're going to talk about, just a heads up, spiritual roadblocks that get in the way. We're going to talk about spiritual practices, even like spiritual gifts and how do we live into those things. We're going to talk about things like abundance and scarcity, which is just things that are coming. But as we're coming to the end of this 4 weeks around transformation, we've been talking about the difference between a transactional kind of faith in life and a transformational kind of faith in life that Jesus invites us into, and the kind of intentionality in life that comes around that, and what it means, and how we live into it, and how often in church world, that's not what's on offer. Often it's a very transactional, very simplistic, kind of overly redacted process of faith and invitation and spiritual journey for a lot of different reasons. But man, the full invitation of Jesus is to a life of transformation. And the reality is that transformation is actually about kicking out of that autopilot kind of mode of living and actually entering into really specific kinds of intentionality. It's about kicking out of that autopilot kind of thinking, which can happen at a subconscious level, and we can even participate in it at sort of a semi-conscious level. That's just what we do. That's just what we think. That's just what we believe. That's just how we behave. This is what our tribe says, so therefore this is how things are. This is how my family raised me, and this is how we act. This is what the woods are. I remember my brother telling me once, articulating it to me. He's like, woods aren't losers, but we're not winners either. We're all just kind of in the middle. That's what we are. And I remember thinking, this is terrible. I want to win some too, you know? And I want to lose. I want the full spectrum. He's like, well, we're in the middle, bud. Right? Or that's just what we've always done. Or this is how things are. This is the way the culture is. This is the way that the world works. This is where it all is and where it's all going. Or even this is just how I am. Like it's autopilot. The book of Lamentations in the Old Testament, chapter 3, verse 40 says this. It says, let us examine our ways and test them, and let us return to the Lord. It says, let us examine our ways and test them, so we can return to the Lord. Or Psalms 119:59 says it like this. I've considered my ways and have turned my steps to your statutes. It talks about let us consider our ways. Let us examine our ways and test them. As we're talking about transformation, we're talking about reflection this morning. Like specifically self-reflection, a life of self-reflection, which it's so easy to cruise on autopilot or live very busy or live very distracted or even very unaware of what's going on beneath the surface of your own heart in your own life. And it's really easy to give in to the human nature that's like, let's just go along with the flow. Let's take the path of least resistance. Let's do the least amount of work to exist as a human. But the reality is the invitation of Jesus is something else. It's really easy to live unaware of what's in your own self, and as a result, never experience the lasting like depth and power and beauty of transformation in your life. Self-reflection is essentially defined as meditation about one's actions, character, motives, and development. That's how I would define it. I should have made a slide out of that. It's a meditation about one's actions, character, motives, in development. It's taking consistent time to reflect on what you're doing, what you're thinking, how you're reacting, how you're moving in your life, why, as well as what you want to be doing and thinking about and reacting and moving in your life. And also what it would take to get there. I mean, so many of us absolutely lack self-reflection in our life. Have you ever had those moments where you find yourself responding to a situation and you're like, that really jumped up there internally. Whoa, I really came in at a 10 and we were talking about spaghetti. You know what I mean? Where was that emotion from? Or where? That was weird anyway. And we just like move on. You know what I mean? Or that was your fault. You provoked me. I'm responding to you. I'm just parroting back my own words to Jen, probably from an argument we had recently. There's so many people that I've known in my life that are about as self-reflective as like a rock. And I only say it because it takes one to know one, because there's been long stretches in my life that I have been exactly the same way, right? Where you just, you don't see it, and you aren't aware. We don't take the time and the space, whether we're just scared, maybe of what we'll find, or if we're just too busy, or if we just don't really know how, but the reality is, for whatever reason, we don't do it. We don't practice this art of self-reflection in our lives, and we, it's when you lack that, you can either get stuck and never be able to move on in your own relationship with God and just feel like you're stuck or even like you're kind of drifting. There's a pastor named Erwin McManus who leads a church called Mosaic in L.A., and he was teaching a class years and years ago at Fuller Seminary back when I was training to be a pastor, and I remember him talking about how he was in his 50s. He was just coming into his 50s, and he's like, when I was in my 20s, he's like, I was scared, and I was like afraid, but I didn't realize it, and so it caused me to operate these certain ways where I like held back, and I didn't actually go for it. He's like, when I was in my 30s as a pastor, I thought I got past it, but I really didn't. I didn't even tap into it, and I was still scared, and like I was afraid to go for it, and I held back, and I wasn't myself. Then I got to my 40s, and I still was afraid and didn't know myself. And in the time, he's like doing all these awesome things in the world, but in his own life, he's recognizing that like, he just lacks the reflection, understanding what's going on beneath the surface, that he's just operating in a terrified sense. He's like, now that I'm in my 50s, I was like, forget it, I'm just going to go for it. And he just like threw everything into the wind, and he's like, if I could only realize this when I was 20, man, it would have been a different ride, right? I had a professor at that same seminary. His name was Rick Beaton, and he said that every time he entered a new decade in his life, like he'd start out at 20 or 30 or 40 or whatever, and he's like, I know myself. I've done the work. I know who I am. I know who I am in God. I've been shaped, and I'm ready to give myself to the world. And he's like, by the time I hit like 39, I'm like, I have no idea who I am. I'm just absolutely don't know. I don't. And he's like, he told me there are so many guys he knows in their 70s and 80s who are like as self-reflective effectively as a rock and are still riddled with lust and self-consumed and don't even know why. They've just never gotten past any of it. They've just been caught in the same stuff their entire life, and they've never been able to reflect enough to figure out what's going on beneath the surface. Think about Peter from the scripture, Matthew 26:35. Jesus just says, I'm going to be taken. They're on their way in. The crucifixion is coming. And he's like, you're all going to deny me. And Peter, you're going to deny me three times before the rooster crows. And Peter's like, even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you. Right? And all the other disciples said the same thing. Later that day. Next slide. Now, Peter was sitting out in the courtyard, and a servant girl came to him. You also were with Jesus of Galilee, she said. But he denied it before them all. I don't know what you're talking about, he said. Then he went out to the gateway where another servant girl saw him and said to the people there, this fellow was with Jesus of Nazareth. And he denied it again with an oath this time. I don't know the man. And after a little while, those standing there went up to Peter and said, surely you are one of them. Your accent gives you away. He's from the country. It's like a country boy accent. Then he began to call down curses. Thing really ramped up there and I was swearing. And he swore to them, I don't know the man. And immediately a rooster crowed, and then Peter remembered the word Jesus had spoken. Before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times. I think there's one more slide. And he went outside, and he wept bitterly. I will die for you. This is where I stand. At the end of the day, he's just crying, doesn't know what happened. Like, he's lost soul out in the darkness. Like, where am I? What? How did that happen? Have you ever felt that way? You're like, I am, no more. I'm not going to act that way. I'm not going to respond that way. When I run into that person, I will not. When I run into mom and dad or that friend or that coworker or that, things are different this time. Or I'm not going, oh, I did it again. Why? I've forgiven them. I absolutely have moved on. And I feel like the Lord has delivered my soul, to be honest with you. I'm like a monk. I'm like a Christian monk of forgiveness. And then like hour or two later, you're pissed. And it just, something came up and you start reliving the story and you're down the line in your head and you're wanting to fight them and you're like, what? You know what I mean? Like you, and then you're like Peter, you weep bitterly, at least in your heart, because you're like, what in the world just happened, right? We're not alone in that reality of not practicing self-reflection. But when we don't learn how to be a self-reflective kind of people, as a result, we end up holding yourself back from the transformation that God intends for you. We can end up holding ourselves back from the transformation that God intends for our lives. And again, maybe we're scared, or maybe we strangely assume that we've arrived, like my professor friend at 20, or that we're further along than we actually are. Maybe we're just too busy, or maybe we're just strangely arrogant, or whatever. But the reality is that the practice of self-reflection is absolutely critical. It's absolutely central to a life following Jesus and this transformational kind of faith and journey that he offers us. Think about the passage in Luke 5. Put that slide up, 5:16. Speaking of Jesus, it says, "But Jesus often withdrew to lonely places, and he prayed." And depending upon your experience of prayer, that can mean a lot of things. Like, did he go up and have these intense conversations? Did he go up on the mountainsides and the lonely places with these lists of requests? Or did he go up and just sit, like we talked about last week, with the art of subtraction, where you're stripping everything away just to be in the presence of God and even trying to quiet your own monkey mind so that you can be present to the Spirit of God and listen? But there's even a whole nother level of the lonely places where you can reflect deeply on yourself and who you are and what's going on beneath the surface. Like a powerful self-awareness and reflection in the presence of God actually is a form of prayer. It's not the kind of prayer where you're just listening contemplatively for the Spirit to speak to you, but it's like a next level kind of prayer. It's like a kind of prayer where you're actually brave enough to open the depths of yourself up before the Spirit of God and just let come out whatever's going to come out. And even if you think about Jesus in those spaces, he had this powerful self-awareness and reflection that he was able to read the scriptures, the Torah, the prophets, the law, the Psalms, in a way of sort of communing with the Spirit to recognize and live into what his unique sort of messianic vocation was going to be, because it went against what all the expectations of everybody at the time was. It's not like Jesus was like, "I am the Messiah, and the culture all says this is what the Messiah is, so I'll just sort of autopilot into that sucker." It was against what everybody thought that it was. That's why they all attacked him. That's why they all freaked out on him. That's why his own disciples abandoned him at the last minute, because everything he was doing was an absolute interpretation of the scripture, but in the deep process of self-reflection in the presence of God, recognizing what his unique vocation would be as it unfolds in the world. That's some like triple black belt self-reflection stuff. I mean, he was able to set his face to go to Jerusalem to be crucified when everything against him like pushed and said no. When everyone pulled and pulled, and he's like, "No, nothing will stop me from this yes that I know that I'm supposed to be about." Powerfully reflective and transformed. To the point that when he was actually on the cross, like imagine if all these people pushed at you this way and beat you and shamed you, and the soldiers and the way they put the thing on, the crown on him, and it was just shame and beating and shame and beating. And then he finally is hanging on the cross. And look at Luke 23:34. What he says to them. They sound like, "You're going to get it, suckers." His "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing." Even as they're shooting dice to take his clothes. Right? Like, that's a deep, deep level self-reflection. To recognize what's going on in himself and in them and in the world. It's almost twofold, in a sense. When you look at the story, it's almost double-sided, because it shows how obviously unreflective the soldiers and Pharisees are in all of the sort of complex motives that led up to him being on that cross actually are. Like insecurity, freaked out. Like if you look at all the political and organizational religious motivators that went behind how Jesus ended up on the cross and all of these other people, and they were able to just sort of pretend like those motives don't exist and just go, "God wills it, we're protecting God," and throw him on a cross. Yeah, the level, the lack of self-reflection in those people is amazing, especially when you juxtapose that to the wildly self-reflective, grace-filled presence that Jesus is, because he's so deeply aware of who he is in the presence of God, as the Son of God, and what he's doing in the world. Unprecedented. I mean, it's beautiful. It doesn't just happen. It's that deep levels of transformation at that level come through that deep levels of self-reflective journey. Or if you think about it even further, the road to Emmaus after the resurrection. Look at Luke 24, just another chapter in the story. The story on the way to Emmaus is that after Jesus rose, everyone scattered because they were confused, because the Jewish people assumed when the new creation came that all of the dead of humanity would be raised at once, like the book of Revelation speaks about, but Jesus was the only one that was raised as the firstborn of this new creation that was coming. So it was quite confusing for them in the moment. So they kind of scattered to the wind. Some were hiding in Jerusalem behind a locked door, hoping they don't get hung on crosses if they're caught. Others just gave up and they're going back to their life. These guys are walking back to Emmaus, a 7-mile walk, and Jesus like joins them on the journey. These disciples who don't recognize him, and it's a fascinating story because he's like, "Well, what's going on, fellas?" And he knows. But he just wants to see what their take on it is. And they tell him the story. We're confused. We're scared. Somebody probably stole dude's body. Like, we don't know what's happening. And then Jesus, in this moment, says, "How foolish you are and slow to believe all the prophets have spoken." Harsh intro. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And then, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. Like, you want to talk about the reflective journey that he's poured through the scriptures and he's been able to understand the ways they spoke about him in ways that no one else had quite yet understood, and then relay that information to these others so they could actually see in like a new reflective light the reality of what the new creation actually looks like in light of the power of the resurrection that just happened. Like, that's some crazy level reflection and speaking and calling and like inviting them in. It's beautiful. It's the articulation of a lifetime of reflection on his life and the scripture and his vocation that he just showed was vindicated through his own death and resurrection. That's like a boom, right? Or just the story of the New Testament leaders in general who then took this and what Jesus taught them, and then they had to go back through their own understanding of what the Old Testament was saying. Because at the time, it wasn't the Old Testament, it was just the Bible. Of what it was saying about Jesus. And if you read through the New Testament letters, you see them calling this out everywhere. This psalm was actually about Jesus. This prophet was actually about Jesus. Like, it's like the storyline that runs through the entire New Testament is them telling this thing that happened at Emmaus to the rest of us so that we can see who Jesus is and how his actions brought about the new creation. It's wild. And it all comes through the reflection. Self-reflection is critical for a life of transformation if we're being formed into the image of Jesus and the power of his spirit. It's the engine. It's the deep process of how we're actually formed. There's a book called Reinventing Organizations by a guy named Frederick Laloux. It's a complex book. He tries to take the idea of spiral dynamics, if you know what that is, then apply it to like the future of organizational development. That's the essence. Super fascinating for into that. Really boring if you're not. If anything, you could read it to go to sleep at night and it would be helpful. But he draws on this reality that we as human beings, we actually have three brains. This is new information for me. I was like, yeah, we got two, left brain, right brain? No, different. Like, we have three brains as humans. We have a huge brain in our head, especially compared to other animals that exist in the world. We have a huge brain in our head, then we have two very small brains, one in our heart and one in our gut, that are both fully autonomous nervous systems working, interconnected to the other brains, but absolutely independent. So three, like, differently autonomous running central nervous systems in our body. It's wild if you think about this. Yet somehow still interconnected, and it's kind of new science from like starting at the end of the 90s, and they're still trying to figure out how it works, but it does make a lot of sense though if you think about like, I knew in my heart. That means something. You did. You have a little brain in there. In my gut, I knew it was the right decision. That's language we use in our staff and elders sometimes. Like, it's just a gut thing. We get it. It really is. That's part of your operating. It's part of your brain. And when we're talking about transformation and self-reflection, I think that's actually what we're talking about. And there's just the new science that backs it up. But it's how do you move something from your head to your heart to your gut or to your body? Like you aren't experiencing transformation until you figure out how to move something in your own life, in your own spiritual journey, just from your head where you're thinking about it to your heart, to the core of who you are as a person and how it affects you from within, but then to your gut, to like how you actually embody something and then live it out in the world. It's like moving it through your whole self. Sometimes we talk about discipleship, we talk about it like head, heart, and hands, which is sort of the same idea, because often we'll like attain a new form of knowledge and we'll think that we've arrived. We're like, I just found out this new idea. Did you hear that podcast? Did you hear what so-and-so said? Did you read that new book, or at least have someone tell you about that new book that you never read? And then you just pretend like you did. Like all the ways that we get knowledge, and we're like, that's it, it changed my life. But nothing's changed. It's just an idea. And in reality, nothing's changed because we haven't moved it down that chain, the central part of who we are, into our heart. So then we'd allow it to overflow into our gut or into our body, into our actions. Or sometimes it actually works the other way around, where we're acting a certain way in the world, we're reacting a certain way in the world, and you almost have to bring it up the chain, pull it out of your gut and pull it into your heart and figure out the why. Like, what's behind the reason that I'm acting like this? Where is this coming from? And then you have to pull it up to your head and sort of process it a bit and then allow some changes to take place and then work it back down the chain to your gut. It's really interesting the way that God made our bodies to operate. Self-reflection in this sort of transformational process is a movement that's way beyond ideating to actually becoming. It's the reality that if we don't reflect, we're going to end up doing the same things over and over and over again. Never growing, never changing, kind of caught in the same cycles, doing the same exact thing again and again and again. It's a movement from consistently doing what already is to moving into a reality of doing what could be, but like the kind of life that God actually has for us. It's why you could say that history always repeats itself. It's because if we forget, if we don't learn, if we don't reflect, if we don't transform, we don't grow, we end up doing the same thing again and again and again, which means it's actually about moving something from our head to our heart to our body to our gut. It's about embodying it and becoming someone and something different. That's like real transformation. And so in that journey, I'm going to give you, there's a lot of things we could say about this, but I'm going to give you four things to consider. Just four very simple things to consider in this process of transformation in your life. One is this, that action doesn't equal growth. Action does not equal growth. It's action and reflection equals growth. It's very important. You can do the same thing again and again and again and again and get the same result. It's insanity. But if you're never reflecting on it, you're never changing. You can end up doing the same thing again and again and again. I mean, I hinted at it a moment ago, but that notion that like a new idea, whether it's, you know, the podcast or the book or the sermon or whatever that changed your life but actually didn't, creates transformation, and it doesn't. It's actually the process of really careful reflection on those actions that creates change and growth. Really careful reflection on those actions. Do you know that with a sermon like this right now, that statistically I've read, within a month you will have forgotten more than 90% of what I say right now. For someone who this loves this whole thing and this craft and gives my whole soul to it, that sucks. Statistically, you'll remember how you feel. And you'll remember a really good story, but you'll forget more than 90% of what I say a month from now. I mean, imagine all the things that you're going to take into your head between now and a month from now. That's just part of the deal, I guess. But if you take notes on it, and if you turn around and share with someone one or two things that you learned from it, you'll retain more than 80%. Isn't that wild? Just from the process of like simple reflection of grabbing some notes and then sharing it. That's wild. To me, that's wild. We're reading this book right now as a staff and as an elder team. It's a book about church and leadership and the future. It's called Canoeing the Mountains. And it's essentially a book taking like theories and best practices of adaptive leadership, but applying them to the church, but especially understanding the changing culture and world that we live in. And his whole premise is the world before us is nothing like the world behind us, and most pastors and churches have been trained for the world behind us. And so he uses the example of Lewis and Clark and the big expedition to find the waterway to the west, and how their idea was, we're just going to canoe over the United States and find the waterway. And they got to the Rocky Mountains, and they're like, wow, that's different. That's really big. And they had to ditch their canoes and figure out how to become rock climbers, which is why I said you can't canoe the mountains. It's the whole premise of the book. But it's such big ideas that he built a study guide into the book. And the study guide is so brilliant because it's broken down into a way of like reflecting on the things that you read in your own life, and then meeting with a small group of people and having very specific questions and ways of reflecting together. And then the third part of that is one-on-one reflecting with somebody else that knows you very well and asking them the tough questions of, where do you see that stuff in me in my life right now? And then after that, you go back to a personal reflection at the very end, where you are then asking some questions of yourself and your leadership and your life and how you're doing it. Like that's I could blow through that book and then read five more and forget what I read. But if you go through that process with your team and your friends and your people, you will not forget what you read. It will change you, and it will change your whole life and trajectory together. It's about the reflection on the thing, not just reading through the thing, right? I have a friend who is an avid reader, but he reads so much he can like forget the details and the concepts of the things that he's read. And so he keeps a log on his computer where after he reads a book, he'll take a one-page document and he'll type out his own summary and all the key learnings that he got from the book. And then he'll save it as a way of trying to like distill his own kind of cliff notes of like, what is this thing and how did it change me and how can I hang on to these things as I move forward? I love that. The key is a consistent space of reflection. The key is like a journal that you would have in your own life. It isn't just action, but like actually taking the space to reflect and having a journal that you're consistently coming to as you're asking the questions of yourself, that you would act and learn and then reflect and then tweak and then act and then reflect and then tweak, and you'd come back to it again and again and again, which allows you to not just address what you're practicing, what you're learning, but even then how you're acting, even like how you're thinking, even what your motives are. Humans are incredibly complex creatures. The movies like to make us very black or white, good or evil. Like it's like that, like, oh, the battle between good and evil sort of movie, The Avengers Part 37. But the reality is we're all quite complex creatures with very mixed motives in our souls and our lives, which makes for very interesting humans. It also makes for an interesting process of transformation. Even as you journal, wrestling with your own depths of your soul and your motives, even reflecting on other people's perspectives. I mean, to get to a point like Jesus where he's like, they just don't know what they're doing. God, forgive them. Like that's deep levels of reflection of your own soul and process and thinking and other people. Do you have space for that kind of reflection in your life? It's different than subtraction, like we talked about last week. It's actually reflection. Like, do you have a space and a plan for that, or a journal that you write in and that you work with? That's one. Action doesn't equal growth. Action and reflection does. Two, consistent reflection allows you to break out of a busy, absent-minded, autopilot pattern of life. I'll say that again. It was a longer sentence than I anticipated. Consistent reflection allows you to break out of an autopilot way of life. The patterns, the like habit, the driving places you didn't mean to, and constant three-point turns. This is like coming to terms with the idea of we just act in the world, but it's breaking out of those habitual patterns. The whole like things are the way they are and I am the way that I am. But if you kick out of that kind of subconscious thinking or unthinking, have you ever gotten like to a moment? I just did this with Jen, where our oldest son just went to middle school. And I was like, oh, like how did we just get here? Like, where did that go? Where did his young child, oh my gosh, we're here. We just got here. He's wearing deodorant. Like, where did that go? Did that just attack us? I'm turning 40 in a couple of months. I'm like, whoa, where did the 30s go? I don't even, what? You know what I mean? Like, where you just stumble into a new place. Yeah. Or even like the, why do I constantly react that way in these moments? Or why does that draw anger out of me? Do you know if you keep asking why, and you can get to a non-defensive place and an honest place in your own soul, if you ask why over and over and over again, well, because of this, but yeah, but why? Well, because of this, but why? Because of this. If you do that 6 or 7 times, you'll get down to some core stuff that's underneath it all, and you're like, well, because I'm really insecure and scared. Or, well, because that really triggers me because of whatever from my child. Like, and if you start to wrestle with those things that are driving your unconscious actions, why do I turn to food when I get in this place and start like grabbing at that stuff? Like what is it in this moment? Or why do I binge these shows in this moment? Or why do I turn to these substances, right? I told you guys about that Made For thing that I'm doing a couple of weeks ago. It's like a, if you weren't here, you just have to go back and listen. I don't have time to tell it again. It's a process of growth and development. This like track that I signed up for because I was interested in applying it towards discipleship and seeing what they had. And they're using a lot of current neuroscience to help understand like the idea of neuroplasticity, that you can reshape your brain, that you can remap those trails that I was talking about. If you stop walking those paths, eventually they grow over again in your mind and you can map new paths. And part of the process they're saying is like so simple. They're like, it's a journal. And when they're talking about like eating and diet, they're like, no, don't have diet plans. They're like, eat what you eat, and at the end of the day, journal about how it makes you feel and what was going on when you did those. It's a matter of processing what's driving me towards these actions. What's that neural path that's getting there? Kind of reflecting on how it made you feel. And you can begin to wrestle with like relationships and emotions and actions and lust and where that's coming from, or anger or jealousy or insecurity or an inability to forgive. Which those places you just sort of like fly off to, and then you begin to get beneath the surface of all that low level of anxiety that exists, like that ongoing sort of refrigerator buzz that's always existing there. And you can reflect and you can sit with it and go, oh, that's what's driving me towards these things. And then as you like bring that up, you can like remap that thing to operate differently as you begin to see it. You reflect, you sit with it. Where did that come from? Why is that happening? Even down to like whatever tribe you were brought up in. Like, if you're brought up in a particular tribe, and even as you're involved in some of these political conversations that are going on and the polarizations, have you found like you're in a conversation with someone and they say something and like the hair on the back of your neck stands up and you're like, nyah! Like something like triggers inside your gut? Like, you were brought up in, so you're a part of a bigger system that you're like just reacting to sort of subconsciously, that you're being reinforced in, and there's a moment to go, whoa, man, the way of Jesus is a third way. It's very different than all of that. And you have to be able to break down those things and those habits and those patterns that are triggering inside of you in all of these interactions to even recognize where they're coming from, so that you can release them in the presence of God, so that you can enter into this different kind of way that he offers. And that's the process of recognizing the air that we breathe and the water that we live in. In learning to become a different kind of people. And learning to become a different kind of people, right? Even for me, with I told you how I get lost driving a lot. I'll map in the same path to get home from work, like every day I'll take the same path, and I'm like, it took me 22 minutes, so frustrated with the traffic, and then one day it's like, Jenzo, why don't you just take a left there and then a right there instead? I'm like, well, I don't go that way. I go this way down the freeway because the freeway is faster. And she's like, well, I don't know. And months we had this conversation. And then one day I saw it and I'm like, I'm going. And I turned. I got home in like 12 minutes, literally like half the time. And I'm like, Jen, there's a new way home. I just never tried it. You know what I mean? It almost takes like the process of reflection when you kick out of the autopilot is actually even being able to take the risk of going, well, let's try a new way to respond to that. Let's try a new way to react to that. And it's all about the process of practicing. Yeah. There's a lot of opinions that are stated very loudly and a lot of reactions going on in the world, but like a hard-earned transformation through reflection is a very different kind of knowing and being in the world. Three I'll say is reflection can like distinguish between stages and states. So when you talk about spiritual transformation, often there's like stages of transformation in your own development that take place and that happen. And there's a bunch of different models and theories and thinking. But the point is, There's stages of transformation towards the likeness of Jesus, whatever you would name those things. And there's times when you can experience like a state of that next place, like, I absolutely forgive that person and I feel so fantastic. And then tomorrow you like suck back and you're not forgiving them anymore. And then there's like an experience of actual stage of liberation from that where you're living in the reality. And the process of reflection is what actually allows you to move like into a full-blown sort of breakthrough in your life. If that makes sense. That story of the brains I was telling you about, the three brains, they actually weren't discovered in the late 90s. There was a discovery in the late 1800s and the 1860s of the brain in the gut by a German doctor and a couple English colleagues, but it was oddly like collectively forgotten by all the medical circles for over 100 years, and it was rediscovered again in the 90s. Like, it's wild they had this breakthrough, this state of, there's a different whole operation going on in our bodies, and like, but we forgot about it because we're real distracted. And then they break through, and now there's a whole new stage of that development of understanding how our bodies work. It's that level of difference between tasting it and then coming back and then actually fully entering into it. The truth is, there's a difference between like a short-term experience of growth and a long-term, and the process of consistent reflection actually leads to a sustainable transformation in your life. And the last thing I'll say about it is this, is that articulation is actually the highest form of reflection, if you time it right. That isn't just about what's going on in your head and in your journal, but actually like being able to talk about it, but only if you time it right. And what I mean by that is, I remember going to Fuller and learning all this new stuff about theology and God and like deconstructing all this stuff, and I was like, it all makes sense. And on the drive home, it was not making any more sense to me. It was falling apart quickly, and I'm like, it was all 3 hours of that guy talking was so it. And by the time I was home, I was like, okay, Jen, I'm going to tell you everything. And it just spiraled into like, I don't think, I was like, I'm just going to bed. I don't even understand who I am right now. You know what I mean? Like, you think you got it, but then you go to tell someone else about it, and you're like, I really don't have it. You know how well you know something by if you can tell someone else in clarity, especially like a child. If you can explain it to a child, you are like a master. So it's beautiful to be able to articulate it, a spiritual experience or an encounter of God. Like articulating a God moment or the ability to reflect and then forgive and release and move on, or even like a new idea, like a podcast or book or a sermon, as you're allowing that to kind of like sit and marinate in your own soul. But often people try to do that too soon, and they try to bypass the process of transformation that's actually happening. And you get so excited to share it. A lot of pastors get caught in this cycle that they're so on the hook to speak and preach and write books consistently that they get in this weird habit of like looking for the next idea. And so you're like an idea junkie that you got it, like you got to, they're slinging ideas, man. And like new stuff, you know, content, because there's all these podcasts now. I've talked to a lot of pastors who were caught in that kind of cycle. And they'll grab an idea, write a book, and release it before they've ever allowed it to fully sit in their own soul and have an experience of the thing they're talking about. It's just another idea that they're spouting out. So by the time they move on to the next idea, this one's never actually affected them. How often can that happen to us? It isn't just a pastor problem. That's like a people problem, that you don't allow it to move into your heart and into your gut. It's critical. Eugene Peterson used to speak about the difference between writing and typing. He's like, everybody's typing. He's like, but I want to be a writer where I actually have something to say. And that's got to come from the depths of who I am. I had a friend who's a pastor, who's a mentor, that says he would never teach anything unless he sat with it for at least 6 months first. He's like, I got to sit with it. I got to live it. I got to let it marinate. He used to call it the marinate. He's like, you know when you go to dinner and they just poured the sauce on right before you got there, and when they marinated it all night. He's like, I want to be that kind of host that marinates this thing all night long. But when it's ready to share it and articulate it, oh, it's profound. A friend of mine who does documentaries recently told me and Christine that he's found that most people don't know how to articulate their story anymore. Like, you hear the idea of evangelism and like sharing your faith, and it becomes this like pushy, overwhelming thing, but it's just not. If you let the transformational power of the living God marinate in your being over time and transform you, and you're just sharing the transformational experience that is your life, that's just a sweet gift. That is not a pushy thing. That's like, yes, please. Can we have some more of that? It's powerful. Our articulation is the highest form of reflection. You just got to let it marinate. And so, in that way, just a couple of very practical tools and practices for your journey. There's something called the prayer of examine. It's an old practice of St. Ignatius from the 1500s, which is a really incredible practice, which effectively is taking 10, 15 minutes at the end of each day, and you would sit, become aware of the presence of God and practice like through a series of questions, just like a form of self-reflection before the Spirit. We'll make that available to you guys on our like our weekly email that goes out, so you could jump into that and do it. Another practical tool I would give you is just sit with it. That's it. Just sit with it. Another one is get a journal. If you don't have a journal, you should get one and use it. Another one is you should share it. It's why we do Story Sundays at church, because it's just that practice of sharing our stories of what God's doing in the transformational journey that we're on. If you're not good at it, you should practice it with trusted people. My poor family has to listen to me practice stories all the time. But now my kids love it. They're all, "Dad, tell us a story." Practice it. Our kids are starting this new take-home this week, which is them sharing the story of what they're learning on Sunday. So if you have kids in our church, you can practice that with our kids. And then lastly, I'll just say is worship. If you think about worship and reflection and articulation and practice, it's all that at the same time. We're articulating together the things of God in our midst through these songs. We're acting, we're reflecting, we're giving witness all at the same time. It's a very powerful form of like communal self-reflection together. And so I just encourage you to think about our worship in that same kind of sense. So with that, I want to invite our worship team to come up, and we're going to actually enter into a time of worship together. And I'm going to pray for us that we can experience the movement of the Spirit. Father, I pray that as we continue to follow you, as we continue to be shaped into the image of your Son, Jesus, as your presence is here with us, that you would just continue to beckon us as individuals into this transformational life in you. I pray that you'd give us just the excitement and the courage to continue to strip everything away and open ourselves before you, but then also the courage to open ourselves up before you as well, Father. That you would meet us in that space and you would continue to transform the depths of who we are so that we can continue to reflect you. And I pray that we'd experience that now even as we worship together.